I'm Brandi Cruz. Coming up today on Undivided, Governor Jay Inslee's pattern of lies and concealment when it comes to his carbon tax is undeniable. So what now? Also, a Washington congressman's home targeted with anti-Israel graffiti while his Democratic colleague downplays Hamas violence.
With respect, I was just asking about the women, and you turned it back to Israel.
Plus, the war on gas stoves is real. And it's heating up. That and more coming up today on Undivided. Remember, you can support our show for just $5 a month by signing up at undividedpod.com. Welcome to Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback on this Monday. We do have a lot to get to today, including an absolutely another, yet another blockbuster report that to me shows a pattern of behavior from Governor Jay Inslee that, in my opinion, makes him unfit to continue to serve as our governor. But we're going to detail it for you and talk about really where do you go from here? Where do you go when you have a governor who is so drunk on three terms and one party rule that he doesn't care whether he's caught lying. He doesn't care whether his state agencies are caught concealing and gaslighting. What do you do? We still got 11 more months of this guy, 12 more months. So we'll detail that. But I want to start with something I think real struggle within the Democratic Party about struggle that shouldn't even be happening, but about how to respond to these far left activists who have taken a sharp turn toward anti-Semitism. You know, there have been some Democrats locally and Democrats in Congress who have condemned Hamas unequivocally, who have not tried to paint this false comparison between what Hamas did on October 7th and what Israel did in an effort to defend itself and try to get its citizens back from the clutches of terrorists. Over the weekend, Congressman Adam Smith, who's a Democrat from Washington, who's a very reasonable Democrat, who's very pro-Israel, who has spoken out about this left-wing activism. Well, I guess the punishment for doing that is that left-wing activists go and vandalize his house. Before we get to his statement on this, this is from Como News. Representative Adam Smith says his Bellevue home was vandalized by people calling for a Gaza ceasefire. So they did what they, you know, have done all over, red hand paint all over his garage door, ceasefire, free Gaza. From my understanding, and people might paint that as anti-Semitism, I don't think there was anything specific to, how do I put this? I mean, ceasefire, I don't think calling for a ceasefire is anti-Semitic. I don't, you know, depending on what you mean by free Gaza, if it's from the river to the sea, that could be characterized as anti-Semitism. But clearly it's an effort to intimidate him. As a member of Congress, a Democrat who has spoken out and pushed back against this sentiment that Hamas and people in Palestine are just trying to be free and that, you know, the ends justify the means. So Congressman Smith put out a statement that I thought was very good and that I would hope would convince any Democrats who continue to remain silent on this issue or continue to try to walk a fence on this issue to speak out. He said, last night my house was vandalized by people advocating for a ceasefire in Israel and Gaza. The attack is sadly reflective of the coarsening of political discourse in our country and is completely unwarranted, unnecessary, and harmful to our political system. Throughout the course of my career, my staff and I have continually met with groups from all parts of the political spectrum, including pro-Palestinian and left-wing activists. Did Adam Smith just use the phrase left-wing? Amen. And a little glimmer of sanity. No Democrats ever use the phrase left wing. He said, I remain open to meeting with these groups and discussing our differences and where we can come together in a productive and peaceful way. We must engage with politics in this way and reject the rise in political violence that we have witnessed over the past several years. He says the extremism on both the left and right side of our political spectrum is a threat to a healthy, functioning democracy and has been condoned for far too long. The simple truth is that extremism on both sides is degrading our political system and must be rooted out for our democracy to be able to persist. The world is increasingly complicated and full of tough challenges that require strong leaders. I am committed to taking on these challenges, and this act of vandalism has only made me more determined to remain in politics to ensure that we resolve our differences in a peaceful way that truly reflects representative democracy. I think that is exactly the right statement to put out. I think that him acknowledging, yes, there is a left wing in this country, and the left wing is dangerous. You want to focus so much in the media, and his own party wants to focus so much on the right wing and Donald Trump, which is fine. Focus on that, any sort of political extremism. But you can't focus on that when you turn a blind eye to what has been persistent, growing, active, dangerous left-wing extremism in Seattle and beyond. So I give a lot of credit to Congressman Adam Smith for coming out and saying what needs to be said. And by the way, in early November, Adam Smith was on this show and he did the same thing. This is before this attack on his house, this vandalism on his house. He came on this show, which I think a lot of Democrats are afraid to do, and he spoke out against this brand of left-wing extremism.
Part of the problem is the extreme left-wing activist ideology, which tries to divide the world between oppressed and oppressor. And if you are part of the oppressors, your opinion, you don't matter. You are to be fought constantly. And the way they divide that is incredibly arbitrary and factually inaccurate. And yeah, I think that extremism on the left that says these are the good people and these are the bad people, that's become a much bigger feature of ideology. It's this whole effort with the more, extreme anti-racism approach that basically implies that only white people can be racist. I mean, and basically you can sort of divide it once you figure out the quote power dynamic. And if you are in what they decide to be the powerful class, you therefore, have no rights. You are irrelevant. That extreme ideological way of looking at, public debate on policy issues coming from the left is very dangerous and very problematic.
It is very dangerous. And the unwillingness of so many Democrats to say so is what has allowed it to grow and to fester. Adam Smith, in this political environment, in this state, deserves a lot of credit for coming on this show and saying that. And for in the face of this left-wing attack on him and his family, he deserves a lot of credit for coming out and saying that he is more committed than ever to remaining in office. Remember, Adam Smith has already been primaried by the far left for his job. He got primaried by a pro-Palestine, what I would consider anti-Israel candidate, and he won. And that's going to happen again, and he knows that, and perhaps that's why he's more willing to speak out against that faction, because he knows that no matter what he does, that faction is coming for him, is coming for his job, is coming for his seat. But I also think, and I have a lot of respect for the man, and I think he's saying what he's saying because he knows it's right and because he's not an extremist. Meanwhile, what is his Democratic colleague Pramila Jayapal doing? The chair of the House Progressive Caucus. While her Democratic colleague in the House from Washington State, representing the district right next to hers, while his home is being vandalized by these Hamas sympathizers, what is Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal doing? Well, she's going on CNN's State of the Union with Dana Bash. And when confronted with questions about her moral hypocrisy, she's trying to make this about comparing what's happening in Israel to what's happening in Palestine.
I want to ask you about sexual violence. And it's kind of remarkable that this issue hasn't gotten enough attention globally. Widespread use of rape, brutal rape, sexual violence against Israeli women by Hamas. I've seen a lot of progressive women, generally speaking, they're quick to defend women's rights and speak out against using rape as a weapon of war, but downright silent on what we saw on October 7th and what might be happening inside Gaza right now to these hostages. Why is that?
I mean, I don't know that that's true. I think we always talk about the impact of war on women in particular. In fact, I remember 20 years ago, I did a petition around the war in Iraq.
Have you talked about it since October 7th?
And I've condemned what Hamas has done. I've condemned
specifically
all of
women.
The actions. Absolutely. The rape, the, of course. But I think we have to remember that Israel is a democracy. That is why they are a strong ally of ours. And if they do not comply with international humanitarian law, they are bringing themselves to a place that makes it much more difficult strategically for them to be able to build the kinds of allies to keep public opinion with them. And frankly, morally, I think we cannot say that one war crime deserves another. That is not what international humanitarian law says.
Okay, with respect, I was just asking about the women, and you turned it back to Israel. I'm asking you about Hamas. In fact,
I already answered your question, Dana. I said it's horrific, and I think that rape is horrific, sexual assault is horrific. I think that it happens in war situations. Terrorist organizations like Hamas obviously are using these as tools. Mm-hmm. However, I think we have to be balanced about bringing in the outrages against Palestinians. Yeah. 15,000 Palestinians have been killed in Israeli airstrikes, three quarters of whom are women and children.
And it's horrible, but you don't see Israeli soldiers raping
Well, Dana,
Palestinian
I think
women.
we're not. I don't want this to be the hierarchy of oppressions.
Right.
I think 15,000 people have been killed.
It shouldn't
Palestinians,
be. And which is horrible.
2.2 million Palestinians live in 140 square mile area, which is about the size of Las Vegas, with a population that is four times that of Las Vegas, and 1.8 million Palestinians right now are displaced.
Imagine being asked, as a woman who has been an advocate, claimed to be an advocate for protecting other women against violence, being confronted with a question about some of the worst atrocities against women that we have ever seen in a wartime situation, and giving a meek condemnation followed by however, but, and drawing some sort of equivalency. Now, I'm not saying it's not okay, obviously, to talk about what's happening to innocent Palestinians. But they can be two separate conversations. You can have a conversation about the war crimes being committed against women that have been captured on video without simultaneously segueing to try to make your political point, to pander to your political demographic about the way in which Israel has tried to defend itself from those sorts of atrocities. So here you have a story of two very different Democrats. And that's why on this show, you'll never hear us paint any party with a broad brush. You have a Democrat in Congressman Adam Smith, who has come on this show, who has, yes, talked about the right wing, but also talked about the left wing, who has condemned them, who has talked about their oppressors versus oppressed mentality, who weeks later, at his home, is subjected to anti-Israel graffiti, which you might think graffiti, it's not the worst thing in the world, but make no mistake, it's a threat. It's intimidation. It's if you don't do and say what we want you to do, we're going to come to your home. And he's still willing after the fact to say what needs to be said, to tell the truth, to recommit himself to telling the truth, to say he's more encouraged to tell the truth than ever before. And at the exact same time, you have another Democrat, a progressive, a congresswoman, whose district is just a few miles away, who is doing a yeah, but when it comes to rape. To me, this is this moment. And this is especially true in Washington State, and frankly, it's been increasingly true for the last 10 years. There is a common sense segment of the Democratic Party that needs to bifurcate itself from this far left fringe, that needs to find the courage and the moral clarity to do it and to do it quickly. We've mentioned on this show, there's never been a better time to do that. if it wasn't during the chaos of 2020, during political violence that was carried out in the name of racial and social justice, if that wasn't a good time to separate yourself morally from that faction of the party, I can't think of a better or easier, more politically palatable time to do it now when that faction of the party has taken a turn toward anti-Semitism. I give a lot of credit to Congressman Smith, and I'll tell you what, he's going to be primaried again by a progressive. And it's in a district that Republicans have no chance of winning. And so he has my support when that happens, financially, if he needs Republicans rallied to prevent some far-left extremist from getting into Congress for his district. Do Congressman Smith and I agree on a lot of things? We agree on some things. But I would say there's a huge swath of policy issues we do not agree on. But more and more in Washington state, you're going to have these fights where it's between a reasonable Democrat and a far left wing activist. And Republicans are going to have to decide, is that a race where you help out the reasonable person? Where, oh gosh, there's no R on the ballot, so I'm just going to skip it. Or do you say, here's a guy who we can live with. Here's a guy who's willing to stand up and do the right thing. And here's someone who is most decidedly not. Those races are going to come up more and more often, and you're going to have to decide if you want to be a part of them. All right, I do want to follow up on a story we covered all week last week to let you guys know what happened in the court hearing of Joshua Ellis on Friday. If you're new to the show, Wendy Traynor was murdered by Joshua Ellis back in 2017 in Milton, Washington. It was a domestic violence homicide. She broke up with him. He shot her in the back of the head, left her body to rot for her dad and her uncle to find. And we've been following this legal saga, not just to try to help Wendy's family get justice for her, but you had a case that really illustrated everything that's wrong with our criminal justice system in Washington state. Joshua Ellis, without consultation from the family, was being offered by prosecutors a sweetheart deal to serve less than 10 years in prison for putting a bullet in his ex-girlfriend's brain. And not only that, you had this racial element that factored in the case, which is what we spent a lot of time talking about last week. You had Josh Ellis's public defender, who in pre-sentencing memorandums was suggesting that the judge should not throw out the terms of this really, really low deal, lenient deal, because Josh Ellis is black. Because of the wrongs of the past in the criminal justice system, somehow we need to make up for those wrongs by artificially lowering the sentences for black offenders, no matter how heinous their crime. So we went to this sentencing hearing on Friday wondering what this judge, a relatively young judge, a judge that has spoken out publicly about criminal justice reform, wondering what he might do, because judges have ultimate discretion at sentencing. Just because the defense and prosecutors let Josh Ellis plead guilty to this sweetheart deal doesn't mean a judge has to follow it at sentencing. So when the judge went to make his determination after hearing victim impact statements and then hearing from people in support of Joshua Ellis, I was happy to hear him. And this is the moment where I kind of knew that he was going to throw out the terms of the deal and give Josh Ellis more time. Remember, the deal they agreed to was about 123 months. I was happy to hear the judge address head on the racial arguments that had factored into this case. Here's a clip from Friday's hearing.
I will only note that it is frustrating to have to address race. I do think it is a necessary exercise, and I think this is counterintuitive, perhaps, but it is important to address racism when it arises so that we can dispose of it and then return our focus to the case at hand. So I think it's regrettably necessary, but it does serve the purpose of staying focused on the necessary issues and Mr. Ellis's murder of Ms. Traynor. The parties have recommended a sentence of 123 months. I think that is not sufficient. In weighing the applicable factors, I believe 180 months is just, and that is my sentence. It will be followed by 36 months of community custody.
So Judge Andre Penalver sentencing Joshua Ellis to 5 more years than he would have faced under the terms of the plea. I still tend to think that that's not enough time, but I don't think anyone expected him to throw the book. The max sentence would have been something like 20 to 23 years for second-degree murder, which was the charge in this case that was pled to. But what he said there about the race issue, he's spot on. And it actually made me think about the issue a little bit differently as well. And what he's saying is, sure, you know, given sort of the wrongs of the past, we have to always, if there's an issue that involves race that's brought up, acknowledge it, put it aside, move on. And that's essentially what he's saying. And that's what you should do. Acknowledge it. Okay. Put it aside and then move on and look at it the way that Lady Justice intends us to look at every defendant. You look at the actions. You don't look at the person's race. You don't look at their socioeconomic status. You don't look at whether you hate the way their face looks. You just judge their actions based on their actions and you move on. So I will say I was stunned. I did not expect that particular judge to go above and beyond the terms of the plea, but he did. On Sundays with Subscribers yesterday, we had on Tammy Anderson Black, who is the mom of Wendy Traynor. And given how much we've covered this case, I just really wanted her to reflect on what the family went through to try to get justice for her daughter. How has this all left you feeling about the state of Washington's criminal justice system?
Well, as I mentioned, we've been so failed by our justice system since day one. Out of all this, the person that got the most support, was given the benefit of the doubt, was Joshua Ellis. We had nothing. There was no support for us. We had no say. We had no involvement, really. When it comes to our domestic violence, I mean, I've read quite a bit about domestic violence, when someone is arrested, put in jail, and they bounce right out the next day. What's going to stop that cycle? Where is the penalty? What are they paying? It doesn't really make any sense to me. There needs to be a little more accountability, I think. And these are people that have been previously, usually, have been arrested before for domestic violence. And it's kind of a cycle. But there needs to be some sort of a little more accountability, a little more time in jail.
Yeah, if you want to watch that full interview with Tammy Anderson Black, who again is the mother of Wendy Traynor, it was on Sundays with Subscribers, so just sign up, undividedpod.com. You really feel for that family, but had they not said, we're not going to take this deal sitting down, I think that's what the deal would have been, and it would have happened behind closed doors. And it just points to, for everyone who shared clips about this story, who, you know, reached out to that family, who showed up in court. We had viewers and listeners who showed up in court as well to be there wearing, you know, domestic violence awareness ribbons. It made a difference. It really made a difference. And we can't allow these things, as difficult as these conversations are. You know, I think that there's a big segment of people who would not be willing to confront the argument about Josh Ellis's skin color in the way that all of you were willing to confront it and to say it wasn't right. You know, and again, I don't call it reverse racism anymore. I just call it racism. You know, to suggest that Josh Ellis should get a lower sentence is, in my mind, to suggest that Wendy Traynor, because she's white, deserved less justice. And so I'm grateful for all of you that stood up for Wendy Traynor's family. I'm grateful to the Tacoma News Tribune, which published an op-ed from me, which is probably difficult enough for any in the mainstream media to do. But not only that, to publish an op-ed from a white woman complaining about a racial issue in a criminal case, because I do think that made a difference as well. So again, you can check out that full conversation with Tammy, Wendy's mom, undividedpod.com, undividedpod.com. Justice in the sense of what I think justice would have looked like for taking the life of a 25-year-old girl in that way, but justice considering the brand of justice that we're used to in Washington state. All right, coming up next, we are diving deep into, again, a pattern of lies, concealment, gaslighting from Governor Jay Inslee and his administration. It is getting worse and worse by the day. More people are waking up to it. The question is what happens from here. But first, I've been talking about my success on the Eastside Weight Loss Clinic plan. You know, I've been on every diet roller coaster that there is. I do good for a couple weeks, maybe a couple months. I fall off because I got a vacation or a holiday, and then I never get back on again. And then all my success is just down the drain. The Eastside Weight Loss Clinic plan has been different for me because it does allow you to have a couple days where you're not perfect and then just to suck it up and move on. And that's what you need in a weight loss program. You know, I'm down 37 pounds. I started it more than a year ago, so I've been able to maintain that weight loss. Have there been a couple times where I was like, oh, that wasn't my best day? Yeah, during my wedding, for sure. The couple days after my wedding, Thanksgiving. But the nice thing is that the next day I'm like, oh, it is what it is, because you need a program that can fit with your life or else it's not going to work long term. Eastside Weight Loss Clinic, no prepackaged meals, no counting calories, no drugs or injections, strenuous workout routines, no surgery. They teach you what to eat in the right portions and then how to maintain that philosophy of eating for the rest of your life. So do what I did, what so many others have done. Schedule a free 15-minute consultation with Dr. Ryan Coogan and his team, EastsideWeightLossClinic.com, EastsideWeightLossClinic.com. King 5 News investigators out with another absolutely stunning report about Jay Inslee and the lengths that Washington state government has gone to try to hide the impacts of the carbon tax. And this report, I have to say, is one of the most stunning so far. This segment is presented in partnership with our friends over at Future 42. Turn your frustration into action at future42.org. We have detailed over the last couple months some of the things that Governor Jay Inslee, his administration, have done to make us believe that the high gas prices are not a direct result of the carbon tax, are not a direct result of policy that has been his baby, the Climate Commitment Act. And I love the environment. I am in the swath of people, which I think is the majority of us, that want to make sure that this planet of ours can play host to us for as long as possible. That's not controversial. Loving the environment, wanting to improve the environment, save the environment, that's not a controversial thing. But going about it in a way that hurts the working class, going about it in a way where you push policies that you then have to lie about, that you have to keep information from us about, that to me, if you have to do those things to push that policy, it's probably not the best policy. And that's what we're seeing with the Climate Commitment Act, which pushed through this cap and trade program, which I call a carbon tax, that has directly increased prices at the pump. And now in this King 5 report, again from Susanna Frame of the King 5 investigators, they are detailing the story of a longtime public sector economist who says that he felt compelled to resign because he would not lie about the impact the cap and trade program would have on gas prices. The headline, former WashDOT economist accuses state leaders of retaliation for refusing to lie about gas prices. So this is a guy named Scott Smith. He was a transportation planner for the Washington State Department of Transportation for the past 5 years. And his job was about forecasting fuel consumption. So it was literally his job for the state of Washington to forecast where gas prices would be. And he says, and he's been doing this for 35 years, this has been his job. This is his area of expertise. And at the beginning of 2023, what did he predict? Well, he predicted, again, his area of expertise, that the cap and trade program would raise gas prices 45 to 50 cents a gallon. And what happened? Gas prices went up about 50 cents a gallon. But he says, and I'll play a clip from this King 5 report, he says that he felt so much pressure to lie, to leave that estimate out of his official reports, that eventually he just gave up and resigned.
I wouldn't do it because it just wasn't right. I've never had anyone tell me to jimmy the numbers, to come up with some artificial number. I was obligated as part of my duties to produce forecasts of fuel. So I had nowhere to escape, nowhere to hide. And I had to, you know, I guess for lack of a better term, walk the plank. I've been damaged. I'm 64 years old. I've got nowhere to go.
So here's this guy, didn't want to leave his job, was not ready to leave his job, but felt so, I mean, he made a decision I'm sure was hard, the morally correct decision. They wanted him to lie. He wouldn't. He left rather than lie. He left his job and his career with the state of Washington rather than lie. And he's filed a claim against the state. Has this been proven in a court of law? No. But Susanna Frame, who's one of the most respected investigative reporters in the country, felt that there was enough credibility to the story that he was telling to do a report on it. You know, I find it frankly shameful how the governor's communication staff has responded to this, basically saying that King 5 is just not doing its due diligence. And, you know, that's the second time in one of these reports that Susanna Frame has done about Inslee and lack of transparency or outright concealment on climate issues, where the governor's office has tried to make it about her credibility. Her credibility is unquestioned. And that's not political. In fact, I would argue that King 5 is one of the more left-leaning TV stations in Seattle and in Washington State. This isn't coming from some, you know, enemy of the governor. This is coming from King 5 News, the King 5 investigators, and again, one of the longest serving, most trusted investigative reporters in the entire country. And that kind of shows you when you're over the radar as a journalist, when you've got the subject of your story, the governor's office, trying to make it about you, trying to make it about your credibility. I would also say one of the reasons why this economist's story sounds credible to me is that, again, this is a pattern of behavior. This is a pattern of lies. This is a pattern of gaslighting. This is a pattern of actively concealing information, hiding information from you and I. And think about what they're hiding information about. Something as important as whether you can afford to get to and from work, whether you can afford to bring your kids to and from school. Lying about something that is deeply impacting so many families in Washington State. And why? Because the governor wants his policy, but he doesn't want to own the consequences of the policy. And when I talk about this pattern of lies and concealment and gaslighting, it is very long. You think back to when the carbon tax was being debated, and the governor's office hates it when I call it a carbon tax, but the cap and trade program directly results in increased gas prices, which to me is a tax on Washingtonians. So I will call it a carbon tax, whether the governor's office wants me to or not. But you think about when this policy was being debated. What did the governor say? He said that the impact on gas prices would be non-existent, if not negligible. He said it would be pennies, just pennies. Now, when the carbon tax finally went into effect on the first of this year, and immediately gas prices shot up, and it was undeniable that there was a correlation to the carbon tax, what did the governor do then? Well, he went on the news and he tried to find other things to blame it on. He blamed it on a pipeline closure.
Would you agree that this could be a direct result of the oil companies passing the amount of money that they have to pay to the state on to you?
Yes, there is some of that. Now, much of it is not related to this law because the oil companies have shut down a major pipeline, allegedly for maintenance, although why they do it in the summer, I don't know. That has restrained supply, and that has been a significant reason for these recent cost increases. It's not all this law.
When the governor realized that wouldn't work, what did he blame it on next? Well, now, and this is what he continues to blame it on, the greedy gas and oil companies.
They're not just passing it on. They're padding their pockets with this. And that's what's outrageous. They haven't just increased their numbers because of the cap and trade, which, by the way, have always been high in the Northwest because we are kind of an island of supply.
So he can't lie about it. He can't get away with lying about it once it's obvious for everyone. So, okay, now this led to increases. Well, let's tell everybody that it was made worse by a pipeline closure. People aren't buying that. Okay, let's tell everyone, oh, what do Democrats love? They love to blame, you know, big greedy companies. So let's blame it on greedy gas and oil. But the problem is, the more that you lie, the more you spin, the more you conceal, the more people are left wondering, if the policy is so good, why do you have to lie about it? If the policy is the right thing to do for the state, why do you have to lie about it? And that isn't the only narrative where the state has tried to hide the impacts of that program. You'll remember what I still think is one of the biggest scandals politically that I've covered in the state in more than a decade. When Puget Sound Energy went to the State Utilities and Transportation Commission and said, hey, because of the carbon tax, we got to tell people that their rates are going up 3%. And Puget Sound Energy wanted to put it as a line item on your bill so you knew why your bills were going up, why it was getting more expensive to heat your home. And what did the State Utilities and Transportation Commission do? Well, acting on advice from the Attorney General's office, they advised Puget Sound Energy not to put that as a line item on your bill. You recall the story from the Chronicle. Washington AG's office advised Utilities Commission to conceal carbon tax impact on energy rates. So you've got the lies initially from the governor's office that a program designed to increase gas prices wouldn't increase gas prices. You have, allegedly, the resignation of a state economist whose job was to forecast gas prices, who said he was asked, he was told to lie about it, left his job rather than lie to you about the impact this would have on your pocketbook. You have Governor Jay Inslee, who proceeds to come up with various lies about the reason gas prices were increasing so significantly. You have the State Utilities and Transportation Commission acting on the advice of the Attorney General's office, telling Puget Sound Energy to hide the reason for their rate increases. It is a pattern of lies. It is a pattern of concealment. In my eyes, it is a pattern of government misconduct that cannot be ignored, no matter what side of the political aisle that you're on. These lies impact you. These lies are about something as important as your family's budget, as important as your family's ability to make ends meet. And these lies come out of their mouths so shamelessly, so easily. When is enough enough? You know, I know that we have a year left of Governor Jay Inslee, and that's it. And he's not running for another term. But I would argue that one of the reasons he believes that he can get away consistently with this level of deceit is because not because he's been the governor for three terms and he's not running again, but because of the one-party infrastructure that has been built up around him. When there is one party in control for so long, one party in control of the governor's office for 40 years, one party in control of the House and the Senate in the state for 8 legislative sessions in a row, and for most of the legislative sessions of the past 20 years, there is a level of arrogance there where he feels like Teflon. They feel like they can lie, they can deceive, they can conceal from the people who they're supposed to serve. That is the danger of one-party rule. That is why I'm so hard on Democrats. Because there is nothing that they can't get away with. And with Governor Inslee, it goes beyond just the impacts of the Climate Commitment Act. Remember, we told you the other Susanna Frame story with King Five, where the governor set all these climate goals. And at the beginning of his time in office, he announced this wonderful website that would track those goals and that would let the public know if they were meeting those goals. Fast forward 11 years, they haven't met any of them. Recycling's down, carbon emissions are up, and the website the governor introduced to such fanfare the accountability structure. That website was basically scraped of any mention of the goals so that it made it more difficult for people to track them. It's not only climate issues. There's a story about Governor Jay Inslee and the Attorney General's office thwarting a police investigation into what was happening at a juvenile detention facility. Not allowing police to go in there and to service, they had to get a search warrant to go serve, to go search and break up illicit activity inside a state-run juvenile detention facility. The governor was called out on it, and he says basically they should have come to me. I wouldn't have made him get a search warrant. They did come to him, though. They sent him a letter. So again, it's a pattern here. And your question as a Washingtonian, whether you are right, left, or center, is are you okay with the pattern? Are you okay with the evidence that shows and proves the pattern? And if not, then what are you going to do about it? All right, that segment was brought to you in partnership with our friends over at Future 42. Turn your frustration into action at future42.org. And I know they have a lot of opportunities to get involved and try to push back against things like this that aren't good for any of us. We've been talking about the tenant landlord issues and some of the awful, I hate to say awful tenant protections, because there's nothing wrong with tenant protections, but we've seen what has happened in Seattle where they've just gone too far and you have a lot of people abusing the system. And then they just passed Measure One in Tacoma, which has even more strict rules for landlords than even in Seattle. And so we were kind of curious, and we'd been talking about on the show, what are small landlords going to do in Tacoma? Are they going to sell their units? Which again is flying in the face of what, you know, people who say they claim to care about affordable housing. If small mom and pop landlords sell their units, then that is going to hurt affordability in the city of Tacoma. So to me, it's all just very backward. But we figured we'd do a little something different this week with Wes Jones, who we obviously is one of our wonderful show sponsors, because we found out that Wes Jones owns units. He's a small mom and pop landlord in Tacoma. And so we had him on to talk about that. And he says that those new tenant laws, they are making it very easy. And this will be the case in Tacoma as well. Very easy for people to game the system and take advantage of a landlord's good nature.
We continue to see more and more aggressive landlord-tenant laws being passed in favor of the tenant rights. Like you go down to Tacoma, mm-hmm. we are practically back at those, you know, COVID anti-eviction restrictions with what they have passed down there if you really want to jump through the hoops and work the system. Except what's not available right now is the help for landlords should one of those people choose not to pay. And I'm saying choose not to pay because there are plenty of people who are choosing not to pay. It's not that they can't, they choose not to.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, that is the case. And I'm not saying every single issue between a tenant and a landlord is the tenant's fault. Certainly there are some bad landlords out there, but we know that that is the exception, not the rule. And we asked Wes, are you going to sell your units in Tacoma? And he says he's sort of monitoring to see how things go, but he does plan to sort of diversify, which maybe sell a few in Tacoma, buy a few in other areas that don't have such strict landlord-tenant laws. If this is something that, if you're a small landlord and you're thinking about selling your rental properties, reach out to our friend Wes Jones, sellwithwes.com, because not only does he deal with this personally, but he can also help you if you do choose to put them on the market. Sellwithwes.com, sellwithwes.com, a better way to sell your home. All right, ladies and gentlemen, they said they weren't going to come for your gas stoves. They are coming for your gas stoves, and in the process are making it even more difficult for builders to build affordable housing in the state of Washington. Let's get to it in our segment, Unbelievable. Okay, so there's been this kind of ongoing fight, and maybe you aren't privy to it until now, but I'll catch you up to speed, where basically in Washington State and California, there was a similar ban. So this is all going to play into one another. But Washington had passed a heat pump mandate, and a federal court ended up overturning a similar ban in California. And so then the heat pump mandate in Washington State was sort of put on the back burner. But now, as a way to, I guess, finagle around that court ruling, they have passed and put through a watered down version of the heat pump mandate. Here's a story from the Seattle Times, and I'll explain to you what all this jargon means. WA adopts new rules to phase out fossil fuels in new construction. And according to the Seattle Times, this is the first line of their story, it will soon become nearly impossible to install fossil-fueled appliances to heat new homes and businesses in Washington state. So what that means under these new building code amendments that were just adopted, builders would have to, according to the Times, match the energy efficiency of heat pumps in order to install gas in new commercial and residential buildings. The requirements could go into effect as soon as March 15th, unless there's any sort of legal challenges. It says, rather than outright requiring electric heat pumps, it would make it more cumbersome and expensive for builders to meet energy efficient targets without installing heat pumps. So basically their workaround is, okay, we don't know if we can outright ban the requirement that builders install electric heat pumps, but here's what we'll do. We'll wrap it up in so much government red tape and bureaucracy and make it so incredibly difficult to install anything but an electric heat pump that they'll basically be forced to have to install an electric heat pump. One of the issues here, though, and why you've seen the builders push back against this, we've reached out today for comment from the Building Industry Association of Washington, is that this adds thousands of dollars to the cost of building a new home. And this has been one of the primary complaints of builders in Washington state, is they have all of this, these government requirements being added to their slate, including this one, which Governor Jay Inslee said is, you know, designed to save the environment. And then the state turns around and wants them to build more affordable housing. We need more affordable housing. Well, you can't build affordable housing if it's not affordable to build. So you're adding all these mandates to builders. It's increasing the cost of new home construction. They've also increased the waiting time to be able to get permits, which increases the cost of new home construction. So you're increasing the time it takes, you're increasing the cost to be able to build a house, and then you turn around and say, well, we need more affordable housing. None of it makes any sense. And I would argue that it is more unbelievable in the context, really, of what's been happening in Washington state, because this particular rule, and I'll just say, when we also talk about transparency and accountability from Governor Jay Inslee on issues related to the economy. So the Washington State Building Code has 15 members, and who are they appointed by? They're appointed by the governor. Okay. So the government wants this heat pump mandate. The governor wants a heat pump mandate. He wants to shift from fossil fuels to electric appliances in homes. Heat pump mandate, deeply unpopular, expensive, but he appoints the people to the commission, to the Building Code Council. So the governor stacks the Building Code Council with people who will fulfill his climate desires, and they push on these policies that make it more expensive and timely and costly to build homes. On top of all that, when the governor appoints people to the Building Code Council, he's done it in the past illegally. This was a story from May 2022. Inslee settles lawsuit over building council appointments. Inslee's appointments to an obscure regulatory panel have cost Washington state $70,000 in public records lawsuits and forced the governor to name new appointees. It says the dispute centered on Inslee's handling of appointments to the Washington State Building Code Council, which establishes minimum standards for new construction. State law says two of the council's 15 members must be nominated by trade associations representing residential and commercial builders. But last year, Inslee ignored the builder recommendations and instead named two of his own picks. Again, pattern of lies, of concealment, and of getting away with it. This was sort of an obscure story. It was only covered by the wire services. So here you have Governor Jay Inslee making illegal appointments to the Building Code Council, stacking it, as if 13 appointments that were completely his own choosing weren't enough. The two that the trades are supposed to nominate, it's like, I'm going to take those two. Thankfully, he got caught for it. Then he wants to push through things like a heat pump mandate because, again, he has set these goals and Washington lawmakers have set these goals related to emissions. State lawmakers adopted a target of slashing energy consumption in new construction by 70% by 2031. And by 2050, buildings should not be producing greenhouse gas emissions. So the governor has, you know, all these goals, but what did we learn a couple weeks ago from King 5 News? The governor doesn't meet these climate goals. Washington state isn't meeting these climate goals. And what happens when they don't meet these climate goals? They conceal the evidence. Is anybody not seeing the pattern here? Let's create goals for the climate that will make our constituents feel good, like they're doing something. When we don't meet those goals, let's hide it. Let's vilify the reporters who talk about it. Let's strip our government websites of the information. Let's conceal. When people find out about it, let's lie. It is a pattern everywhere they go. And at the same time, they have all this money coming in. They have all this money coming into their coffers. Could it be that that's really what's going on here? Could it be that they know that these goals they set aren't realistic? That the programs that they come up with aren't working to help Washington meet its climate goals? I mean, they've got to know it by now, right? They're not meeting their climate goals. And then they don't want people to find out they're not meeting their climate goals, so they hide the information. But if you really cared about the environment and you weren't meeting your climate goals, wouldn't you adjust your plan and your policies so you could meet your climate goals? Or could it be that they don't care that they're not meeting the climate goals? All they care about is the money that those climate goals bring in from you, hardworking taxpayers of Washington. I know what I think. And I think it's pretty unbelievable that they still get away with it. All right, we'll dip outside of Washington State coming up next. But first, I've been talking about my friends over at Firstmark Insurance. Dave Taylor, the CEO of Firstmark, has been doing this for a really long time. And Mike and I are now members of the Firstmark family. It's because we not only love the service, but we went to them, said, hey, we need better insurance. We're really worried about whether that would cost us more money, and it didn't. So that's a no-brainer. We get better insurance for the same price as we were paying some of the major carriers. Okay, well, sign us up. I've heard from a lot of you who have taken the Firstmark Challenge. For some of you, Dave Taylor told you, hey, your insurance is actually pretty great. You don't even need us. For others, you're now saving hundreds of dollars a month, which adds up to thousands of dollars a year. The caveat is, Dave Taylor and his team at Firstmark, they're not going to be able to go through all of this and get you a quote and all that in 15 minutes or less. That's just not realistic.
How much time did it take for you?
Couple hours.
Okay. So
total.
All in a couple hours. Yep. From the time we gather the information, do the presentation and go through everything, it's a couple hours of time.
Yeah.
Right. And so, and I would say that's probably on the high end.
Yeah.
Right.
It ranges. We were chatty. We were very chatty.
A little bit chatty. Yes, exactly. Anywhere from an hour to 2 hours is the investment in time to find out. And there's no obligation. There's no extra fees if you become a Firstmark client. We are paid the same way every other insurance agency in the state of Washington is paid. We're paid by the insurance company that is the writer of your business. And so, yeah, there's nothing to lose.
Yeah. So if you're maybe doing some budgeting in your family, given the cost of everything right now, given the carbon tax, whatever it is, and you're like, gosh, we really need to save some money where we can. Everybody needs insurance, but having someone in your corner who's working for you and not the insurance companies, I'll tell you what, it's one of the best decisions Mike and I have made as a couple. Firstmarkinsurance.com, firstmarkinsurance.com. Take the Firstmark Challenge. See if they can't save you a little money, if they can't get you better insurance, or both in the process. It'll just take you a little bit of time. Firstmarkinsurance.com. They work for you. All right. Dipping outside of Washington State, although there is an unfortunate Washington angle. This is also going to be the subject of our daily subscriber poll, which I'll get to momentarily. The USA Today compiled data, and it looked at how many adult children, so 22 to 40 years old. So how many parents are supporting financially their adult children? And I'm glad they started age 22, because usually before that, everyone's in college. It's like, well, that would be like 100%.
Right.
If it's like, are you supporting your kid at 19?
Well, 40?
Yeah.
But 40?
Okay, I don't know. 40 is the new 50. Yeah. I don't know.
Or is it the new 20?
Sorry. 40 is the new 30. 40 is the new 20.
Sure.
Yes. Good. Okay. I went in the wrong direction there. Como News republished the USA Today findings because Washington is first in the U.S., for parental financial support of adult children. It says, according to the study, parents in California, Washington, and Virginia average more than $800 per month in financial compensation for their children, ages 22 to 40. Washington topped the charts with an average of $869.50 a month, while parents in Iowa were at the low end of $349 a month. The study also factored in the total percentage of parents who were offering support and the variety of support offered, and Washington was in first place again. So no matter what, like, parents here are helping their adult children more. So as Washington parents are also the most likely to pay for family-wide entertainment subscriptions such as Netflix and Spotify. Oh, man. So we're not even talking about the essentials
it's
here.
Just spoiling
we're
them.
We're talking about, according to USA Today, 51% of parents believe millennials need more financial support than previous generations given the economic climate. I do agree with that for a variety of reasons. But the study also revealed 84% of parents who financially support their adult children say their support doesn't create resentment or tension in the relationship. That's shocking.
Well,
I don't know. You guys must have really good family dynamics.
I don't know, but if you're paying for everything, don't you just keep your mouth shut?
Well, that might be it. But then wouldn't that create resentment from like the parents?
Not if they have the money.
I made this the subject of today's daily subscriber poll. If you're a subscriber on Patreon or Locals, we send one of these out to you every single morning. I said, if you have an adult child, are you giving them any financial support? Any financial support? You get to choose yes or no. We'll keep this poll open. Right now, most people are saying no, but not by much. 42% to 58%. 42% say yes, 58% say no. Chris Holbert says, my 21-year-old son moved to Florida. F you, Jay. 18-year-old daughter is finishing up her senior year, so I'm 1 for 2. Nicole says, my oldest two are over 18, one just barely. They both live with me. I don't give them anything. They help out around the house, which I think is good. Andrea says, I have one adult son with a daughter that I often need to help. Being a single working parent with custody and no child support is difficult. I also have three adult daughters with children that don't need any of my support. Cynthia, we have not provided financial support since the age of 30. One is 48, the other is 37. Prior to them turning 30, we let them know that was the cutoff.
I think that was my cutoff as well. I think that's 30? What my parents said. All right, you're on your own.
I don't think I ever had like a cutoff per se, but maybe would have gotten there if I didn't cut it. I mean, because I was, when my first job in news, I was making like no money, you know, and I constantly needed help from my mother.
It's very hard to make money in this business anymore.
In news. And then one day I was making good money in TV.
But you were kind of an anomaly in that.
I was an anomaly, but that's why my mom was like, you're quitting your job. What? I mean, she was supportive, but also I'm sure she was thinking about, I don't want to go back to those days where you called me like begging for money to make your minimum credit card payment. But I do agree with the sentiment that it does. Well, first of all, and we talked with Zach Bulwark about this, I think, last week, that kids are way more materialistic these days.
Extremely.
Way more materialistic. Mm-hmm. And I also think there's just more things to spend their money on. We mentioned Netflix and all this stuff, and kids get used to it, and then they're spoiled. And it's like, well, I can't get my triple frappa mochaccino latte, which is $11, and they want that every single day. And then, I mean, that might be hard for... I'm not a parent, so I always try not to judge parents who on their decisions, like cutting their kids off or not. Right. I'll tell you what, though, my kids are going to work.
You're having kids?
I don't know. I don't have an announcement to make. No, I don't know yet.
No, I'm with you. I also think that the reason the age has jumped so high or far might be that we're in the age now where there's not the same kind of pensions, there's not the same kind of retirement coming to us, right? So the people now who are parenting these 30, 40-year-olds are retired and they have this pension and they have saved well. The people now that are taking advantage of that are learning that they don't need to save because they're being supported by government or by parents or whatever. So I say in about 30, 40 years, we're in trouble.
Oh, yeah. They're going to be absolutely screwed. And it's something that I've had to think about in this job because, you know, I went from having a 401k with a wonderful match to not having that match and just sort of it all being, I'm sorry, Nicole, maybe one day I'll be able to match your savings contributions. Otherwise, we're both screwed and we can find something to do when we're elderly, some sort of work. We'll be here doing this podcast.
We'll be doing this forever.
90 years old. But yeah, and also, you know, I know that money was obviously, I mean, inflation and all that, but homes were, I mean, they were buying homes for like $8,000, you know, like 20 grand. It just has changed a lot above and beyond what the standard sort of inflationary rate would be or cost of living adjustment. But a lot of it, I do have to agree with what Zach said about materialistic. I mean,
well, and the inflation has risen and nobody has changed their spending. So right. You still have the same amount of money. You still are spending more. And
yeah. But I think of, you know, how adjusting. Many vacations I went on mm-hmm. when I was in college or just out of college, you know, all across the mm-hmm. world with my friends. My mom, my parents never did that. You know, their vacation. I remember we took one vacation when we were kids. Yeah. I think we went to Cancun like 1 year, one time. It was the only, and I remember it because it was like stood out. So the spending habits are a lot different.
I think that's part of our, we phrase it all the time now, like the YOLO, like you only live yeah. once and yeah. you don't know, like live for today. And like all of these sayings that we have that are like live now and don't worry about the future.
Yeah.
And nothing's guaranteed. Like that was not on our parents' radars. No. They were like, nah, save for later because our parents aren't helping us. So. Yeah. We have to save.
Yeah. I don't know if it's YOLO, but also, you know, you should still worry about the future a little bit.
Oh, I absolutely think so. Kiddos. I just mean that's the mentality we're giving kids today.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I agree. And then they got to go somewhere post on my Instagram a picture of me living a life that is completely contrary to the life I actually live and make it look all interesting and fancy and stuff. Right. Mm-hmm. Okay. Anyway.
Or I think I might be able to live on being an influencer forever. Mm-hmm. Like that's not going to go away.
Let me ask you this. I just had to say it one more time. Are we influencers?
I think to some extent, I think though that we're creating something we think we can build off of and create a career out of, right? This is a new career, but we think we can take it far. Or if not, we're still gaining skills that might be able to place us in, you know, politics or
I mean, this
something
is,
like that.
This
right?
is our profession.
It is.
Now we're just doing it on social media.
Correct. But I think that when I think of an influencer, I think of somebody that right now is telling people like what product to buy or what whatever on social media. And at some point, they're going to lose steam, right?
Yeah.
So you only can, you know, I don't know, there's stupid people that like, you know, take selfies in dangerous positions and things like that. You're not going to keep people watching for the forever.
You know
people
what I'll
grow
do?
Out of you. People grow out of the, I mean, fads last for only so long, right?
Because now, you know what we'll do when we're older? Sell foot pics. See, okay. Look at that.
Yeah, that's true. There's a real.
You into that?
I think they like it without the shoes and socks. Don't go there today.
You see? Wait, I can't because you're on my split screen. I'll sell foot pics. I'm more flexible because I've been doing yoga, so that's the only way I can get my foot above the table. Anyway, wow, we're off the rails.
Yeah, let's, if it was summer, maybe.
Sorry, okay, let's skip this next story. We'll get into questions and comments. It's a good segue, though, into Zach today. We have our friend Zach Abraham on the show every week. On Thursdays in this past week, he was talking about the spending during the holiday shopping season. It was actually pretty good. And we were wondering, okay, what is that signal for the economy? And we asked him about this phenomenon called doom spending, allegedly, where you're just so, like, burnt out about the world. You just don't care that you're not saving. You don't care that you're spending more than you're bringing in. And we asked him about whether that was real or whatever.
We look into finance and economics and all that kind of stuff. There's just a very large part of it that's based on human behavior. And I don't think enough people give that enough attention. And I think it's kind of an extension off what a good buddy of mine refers to as financial nihilism, getting $5,000 checks in the mail, government handouts. I think it's created a swath of younger folks, usually, you know, 35, 30, somewhere in there and younger, that have become rather nihilistic about a lot of things. And it doesn't surprise me at all that that extends to spending. Society is more materialistic than it's ever been. I think if you don't think so, go look at social media. Go look at the age groups that are most involved in social media. And isn't it interesting that these people continue to doom spend, quote unquote, even though they're out of capital? You know, it's perfectly consistent with everything else we've seen. So I don't really think it's a new thing. I don't think it's an economic phenomenon. I do think that things like that are delaying the recession or have delayed it. I think it's starting. I mean, it appears to be starting now or starting in the near future. I don't think you can glean anything good or bad from the Black Friday results.
Yeah, and actually, Andy Stevens just reminded me of this in the chat because Zach talked about it. There was a study done where it was like, if you're, how much money would you be satisfied with? And for our parents' generation, it was like something like $100,000. And then for millennials, it was $500,000. We'll be like, you're comfortable, right? So yeah, I mean, I do agree with his assessment of why there is so much spending, particularly among that age group. To hear more chat about the economy and more advice from Zach Abraham with Bulwark Capital, check out his radio show, knowyourriskradio.com. Knowyourriskradio.com. We'll have him back on again this Thursday. All right, questions and comments from the live stream. Greg Anderson says, Brandi Cruz for governor, then after she straightens out the state, president. I am old enough to be president, finally, unfortunately. Mandy, if I thought I could win the governor's race as an independent, I would have done that. But I just think that's a little bit of a tough sell for now. 28's my lucky number. I don't know. Mandy says, influencers push consumerism. You guys are infofluencers.
I know. I like that.
I like that too. Infofluencers.
Name.
Mm-hmm. Jayapal, on her comments, you know, both siding the debate around rape from Hamas. Vicky Berg, rape is a tool? Are you kidding me? I mean, yeah, I mean, you could look at it in the way that Jayapal looks at it is, okay, this is a tool they're using to scare and, you know, but it's obviously much more than a tool. I mean, they raped and killed women, and it's just horrible.
Well, Nicole? I would call that a weapon, not a tool. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a tool kind of dumbs it down. You like get things done with a tool. I would call it a weapon.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, you want me to go? Sorry.
Join us.
The way Jayapal deflects that direct question and not condemning Hamas for sexual violence against Israel women shows who she supports. It almost sounds like she is justifying Hamas raping girls and women because they are at a disadvantage and of not having allies. Is she serious?
Yeah, and I will say the condemnation has been pretty swift from Democrats and Republicans. I'd like to see more Democrats come out. But yeah, Darla said, good for the interviewer. It's about time they're taking to task for their behavior. And I do give Dana Bash credit for persisting. I almost wish she would have been more persistent. Mm-hmm. Like you see, because she kind of pointed out, she didn't want to move on without pointing out that I just asked about this and you switched it to that. So I don't know. Jayapal was before the attack on Israel. Remember, she had called Israel a racist state and there was a lot of outcry about that. And then she came out and kind of apologized for it. I don't know if she plans to do the same. Nicole, will you check her Twitter to see if she has in the last little bit said anything? But she's, I think, under a lot of pressure. On Wendy Traynor and the resolution of that case, Bill Biz with a $20 super chat. It's absolutely ridiculous that the Pierce County prosecutor would promote such a horrible deal. Cowardly. Great that the judge rejected it. I agree 100%. Charlie Knowlton, it's sad that the current climate is such that the defender believes she can even get Ellis a generous plea deal by just making it an equity issue. I agree. On Governor Jainsley, oh, our friend Todd Myers commented. Uh-huh. Hi, buddy. When the governor blamed the shutdown of the pipeline for the price increases, the pipeline had been reopened for nearly a month. He is the governor of the state and has no idea what he's talking about. Or he doesn't think you have any idea as the citizens what he's talking about. So he's just throwing stuff out and seeing what sticks, or both. Marcel says, wow, I didn't know all of this. No wonder why politicians don't want to talk to you. You show the government misconduct in all its truth. And I wouldn't say this earlier. Mm-hmm. Is this not rising to the level of misfeasance or malfeasance? To me, it has risen to a level of official misconduct. And I realize he's only in office for another year. But at the same time, he's just gonna continue to get away with it? The evidence is so overwhelming. And again, it's not like it's some political enemy or right-leaning news outlet that's just hating on the governor. It's King 5 News repeatedly now, three times on the governor concealing information. And do you really think, by the way, that WashDot would try to pressure this economist to lie? Without them being under pressure themselves to make it so? Come on now. You guys know better. Mike Whitman says, gotta admire their obtuse nature. Our power grid is already struggling, yet they plow ahead on EV and all electric homes. By the way, electric hot water heaters and furnaces are less efficient and cost more to run. And we all know it heats up your food less quickly. I mean, once I get my gas cooking, it's flame right away.
True.
I'm not waiting for that little sad thing to like turn red and like heat
I
up.
Have. Yeah, I know.
Lame. Mm-hmm. You could pry my gas stove from my cold, dead hands. God, what is so good?
Don't tempt him.
There's this. Oh, somebody tell me in the comments. Mike watches the Outdoor Channel relentlessly.
Okay.
What is the former rock star, Ted Nugent, right?
Yes.
Wait, is that what you were just said? Did you just say Ted Nugent before I said that?
No.
Ted Nugent, on the beginning, he does these songs. And he has this song called Come and Take It. It's like, come and take it. I want him to remake that. But instead of gun imagery, it's just gas stoves.
Okay.
Come and take it. You know, we could do that.
Yeah, like a Weird Al.
Yes.
Of Ted Nugent
that's
song.
Good.
Ted
that's
Nugent
good.
Sometimes does more what seems to be like, you know, those kind of songs. What
yes.
do they call that?
Oh, I like that. Yeah, if you guys
cool.
know, first time I was watching that, I was like, this song's really intense.
We will make our own video.
But, yeah, we will make our own video. It'll be great. Okay, that's good for questions and comments today. Thank you, Nicole.
Yeah.
Appreciate it.
And by the way, Jayapal, were you asking if she has apologized?
Like, has she come out with an apology?
Oh, no. She's doubled down. She's just reposted those videos and just says, let's see, there's three different reposts. Republicans are holding aid to vital foreign aid hostage in exchange for policy changes that would absolutely destroy our asylum system. It's cruel and a non-starter. Democrats have real solutions, blah, blah, blah.
But
and
I will then, say, she shared the Dana Bash interview, but she cut off those parts. She just clipped it without that stuff on it and clipped off the Dana Bash. Is it Dana Bash? Dana Bash. Pushbash.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, okay.
Yeah, anyway.
All right, we'll continue to monitor that and see if something is forthcoming. Let's get to our closing sanity check. For all of you who say your vote doesn't matter, may I introduce you to Damian Green. Damian Green was running for city council in the city of Rainier. And Damian Green lost by one vote, 247 to 246. The one vote that he lost by was his own. Because Damian Green did not cast a ballot for himself. The King 5 article says, following a hand recount, voters in Rainier have elected Ryan Roth to the city council by a margin of one vote. Green said he did not vote for himself. I didn't feel comfortable, he said. I thought it was kind of narcissistic, so I didn't. First of all, you're running for politics, so narcissism kind of comes hand in hand with that.
And actually, the guy he was running against wasn't going to vote
for himself.
Same kind of reason, and his wife told
Made
him he
it.
Should.
That's because women are smart. Oh, Damian Green. I mean, if that's not a lesson on the fact that your vote sometimes does count quite a bit, in fact, then I don't know what is. That has been your closing sanity check for today. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. We sure do appreciate every single one of you. If you have not signed up to support the show yet, there's never a better time. UndividedPod.com, UndividedPod.com, just $5 a month.